Hi, this is David from ESL RPG. Please listen to the end for information about how you can help support and grow this podcast.
Welcome! Before this begins, let me give you a little roadmap, because this ended up unplanned and we ramble a lot. First off, we talk about ideas for how to adapt to the classroom. We also talk about the advantages of more sandbox-style gameplay, more story tree-style gameplay, false choices versus players creating their own solutions to problems versus railroading. And we go from there into difficulties for students of understanding in-game vocabulary and how useful in-game vocabulary might actually be. So let's get to that long, rambling discussion.
So if this was, for example, some kind of tabletop role-playing game completely set in the modern world and only focused on realistic situations, realistic skills, and a classroom activity, that's actually the best way to understand it. You would set a task like, you need to put food on the table.
Right.
How do you put food on the table? Well, option one is you buy food. To buy food, you need to work. It's expensive, you need to work hard, but you could work and then go out and buy food, and you could role play all of that, and it would be useful. It would be a conversation that students have that would be applicable.
Right.
But it would also be completely viable as an option, and it wouldn't matter what kind of food they were talking about or what kind of work they were talking about. Similarly, you could cook food, and again, it wouldn't matter what kind of food you're talking about, what kind of cooking you're talking about. You'd find a way to make the system work based on that character's skills. And even if you're not just cooking, you could hunt for food. I mean, the goal is just put food on the table.
Right. So you basically set the goal, and the people, like, playing the game or trying to achieve the goal, they figure out on their own how to get there.
Right, right. But there's even a level beyond that where the DM just sets the world and that's the situation, and the characters go even as far as to set the goal. Like, maybe you have this world with all these problems, and you as the dungeon master, your original plan is everybody fixes all the problems.
Right.
But maybe the players instead decide, holy cow, Puckies, these problems are too huge. I can't do it by myself. I should leave this to somebody who's a professional. The characters decide, and so instead, they try and adapt and live in the world around the problems.
Yeah, I mean, I think it really depends on the story the DM wants to do. Like,
that's where it gets a little bit, from a pedagogical standpoint, muddy.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
But it like I said, it depends on the goal. Like, if the goal is for the people to study English,
yeah,
right, then I guess it doesn't really matter, because as long as they're talking, as they're, you know, they're communicating with each other, they're speaking English, then the main goal of the activity is established, right?
Yes, but that is true.
If you're playing, you know, like playing Dungeons and Dragons, not as an ESL activity, like just among people, which we're, you know, I guess
kind of doing now.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. But yeah, I guess I think in that sense, there should be a more clear goal.
Well, but there is a word for this in that sense. when a dungeon master controls too much and sets the story too much.
Yeah.
We call that railroading.
Yeah, I know, railroading. Yeah. But, I mean, if you do a campaign, there's always going to be an end goal to that campaign.
Oh, yes, yes.
Otherwise, you could just, you know, like play The Sims in D&D.
Well, if you were to plot it out, there's a couple of different ways to do this. One option is the story tree, where each choice represents a branch.
Right.
And each branch represents a different way the story could probably end. And the more choices you have, the more branches you have, and on and on and on, and nothing ever comes back together.
Right, yeah.
The other way of imagining it is beads on a string. Each choice presents different ways to go, but those different ways to go are focused towards the same goal, so whichever way you choose, you're still following the story.
That's like kind of fake choices, in a way.
If you are too aware of it, it is fake choices. If you do it well,
it's unnoticeable.
It's unnoticeable. Or even if you do it really, really well, it's going beyond unnoticeable. It's enjoyable specifically because the goal has not changed. The player has not chosen the goal, but the player has chosen the way to do the goal.
Right. Okay.
It's like creating your own solution to a puzzle.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. But like, for example, if the goal or maybe the hidden goal, like even if the dungeon master didn't reveal this to the players, that like, you know, the goal is to kill the evil lich or whatever. Yeah. And, you know, the lich is up there in the castle and, you know, in the end, you're going to have to go there and kill the lich, right? But even if you do the, like, the way with the beads, like, you know, hidden choices, whatever, or, like, fake choices, or, you know, like, no matter what they do, that's where they'll end up. You know, if the players just never go to the castle and always be like, you know, no, we're going to be farmers. No, like, next thing I do is I'm going to buy a farm. You know, I'm going to sow these seeds, and next game they're going to, oh, yeah, I'm going to harvest my tomatoes.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you know, I think there's always challenges like this.
Yes and no. There obviously is gravity to every choice, but you as the DM, among other things, you have the power to bring it to bear.
Like, you know, if they make a choice that, you know, like, wouldn't make sense in the world, like if there's evil or you know, like if there's...
Not even that. Let's say, for example, your characters do choose to do a farm.
Right.
Let's say the original idea was just an artifact that they were supposed to retrieve.
Right.
Well, yeah, they could go and retrieve the artifact, but it's inside this dangerous temple, and really, why would you do that? I mean, the only reason they ask you to retrieve the artifact is that it could maybe be used for evil purposes, but it's already protected by this massive temple, so we're going to go farming.
Right. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, as an example. Well, as a dungeon master, you could let them continue farming, let them continue negotiating prices with tradesmen in the neighboring town for a little bit, but then somewhere along the way, bam, their farm is burned down, and they find out, oh, our farm burned down because somebody got that artifact we were supposed to get, and they became a powerful warlord.
Right, so there's like consequences for their actions, basically.
Yeah, yeah. That's kind of, in a way, one of the things that relates back to the choice I was really, really harping on earlier of, yeah, there's this captain over by the lake, and maybe you should bring him back. From a video game standpoint, when you choose to bring somebody back to someplace far away, you actually have to go through walking back to that place far away.
Right, yeah.
But when you're in a tabletop role-playing game, you could just say, Okay, I pick him up, I go over here.
Right, yeah, you skip the walking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, very much you skip the walking. Maybe you roll for random encounters, but so what?
Yeah. Well, I mean, as far as this game goes, I mean, it's like a story I'm adapting from a video game.
Yeah.
But another thing, I want to give, like, the players a choice. That's why I present them with so many things to do. And some of them, like, you know, I'll drop hidden hints to say that, like, maybe you shouldn't do this now because it's kind of, you know, difficult.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I want them to listen to what the characters say.
That actually would be a perfect example where for different ESL levels, you could be more or less direct.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Saying that, yeah, we need this character captured and returned, but he's really, really strong. That's a less direct way of saying, don't do it now. But saying, you are level 2, this character is level 5.
Yeah, I mean, for example. But
yeah.
I mean, if you, you know, like if you talk outside of the game, it kind of breaks immersion. But once again, it's not the, like the goal of ESL tabletop is to practice, use English, learn new things. So it doesn't really matter. But I think for higher level ESL speakers, you know, going out of character, you know, sometimes it's necessary, every tabletop does it, but I think it's more important to stay in character.
Yeah, it is more important to stay in character for higher level. It is more important to encourage people to act as their character for a higher level, but that is exactly like a lower level. You should be encouraging people to interact with the system, and that sometimes requires directness. That sometimes requires not acting out the dialogue, but saying what the dialogue is.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that probably happens in most games that don't do it for ESL.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, in my experience, no.
Oh, really? Okay.
Definitely in my experience, if you are persuading someone, you absolutely, yes, roll for it first, but then follow up that roll with how you persuade.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the fun, right?
Did I tell you the story of the Werebear Winston Churchill drunkard speech?
Maybe. I've heard Werebear before. Like, you've told me events about, like, stories about werebears, but, yeah.
Well, okay, here's the thing where things get crazy. With Vince's game, in the campaign before, there was a time where we were in a massive, huge army versus army fight. And trying to rally the defenders against this huge wave of attackers. And in the middle of that, Vince asked for somebody to try and help motivate the defenders to rally back to the defense line and hold it for just a little longer and whatnot. And the player that fell on was the drunk monk, who at the time, keep in mind, as the drunk monk player, it's worse than Aerie was. I was limited to 50 words. And not only that, but the druid had transformed me into a massive werebear. And Vince asked me, make a charisma check, roll to motivate the troops. And I roll a natural 20.
So basically, after rolling that, you had to give the speech as if you, like, totally...
In that character, with those words, as a werebear, yeah.
I mean, you know, that's what I mean, it's like the fun of it, like...
Yeah!
You know, like, you want your, like, if you do a check or a roll or, like, a... You know, you want your character to succeed, but you have to abide by the rules of, you know, the dice rolls, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then it's really fun to, you know, usually it's even funnier if you mess up a roll.
Yeah.
Because you have, it's like you have this really great action in mind, like, okay, I do this. Then you roll and you fail. It's like, okay, I do this, but instead this happens. But, you know, it's like slapstick comedy in a way.
Slashes the sword at you, hits another person's sword into their friend.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, agreed. Imagine if that had failed, it would be just... and nobody going to the front lines anymore.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Yeah, but it succeeded, and so you have to go, wait, what the Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, how did that succeed?
I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
That's how it is.
Yeah, yeah. But that's one of those things where, again, based on the ESL level, you would have to say, okay, my character says something like this.
Yeah, yeah, of course. I mean, I think we can, like, kind of check the way we've been playing the game now. We have Mai.
Yeah.
Whose English is really good, by the way. But, I mean, she is kind of limited by lack of vocabulary, because Dungeons and Dragons does use a lot of, you know, fantastic words, like fantasy words, like stuff you don't use in real life.
Is it a construction helmet? Is it a driving helmet?
For example. You know,
that's not even vocabulary. That's just cultural differences.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so there's so many things you have to think about. And, you know, I think I'm not a native speaker either, but I like to think my level is high enough. But I know a lot of fantasy vocabulary because I play a lot of games, like video games, like, you know, RPGs and whatnot. So, I know these words. I know these terms. I know what it means. I know what this is. I know what, you know, this magic spell, like this whatever weapon they use like 2,000 years ago that no one knows about. I know what it is because I've used it to save the world or destroy the world in various video games. But, you know, like the average person that speaks, you know, that doesn't speak English, that's studying English, they don't know what it is. And why should they? Because, you know, they probably never heard it before.
Yeah.
I probably think like the average English speaker would know 20% of the vocabulary used in Dungeons and Dragons either, because it's just like, you know, it's fantasy. It's stuff they don't use in real life.
Average English speaker, I'd say closer to 60%.
Oh, really?
I mean, there's a lot of it that it's really...
like niche?
Not even niche. I mean, a lot of the historical weapons, sure, but, for example, the things in the pack, priest pack, you've got a cross or a relic or a book or candles or an incense burner.
Right.
Those may be specific to religion, but they're also general enough that they could apply to any religion. So 90% of English speakers, native English speakers, would know probably all of those words.
But yeah, but those are like words that are used in real life.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you talk about, you know, like spells, for example, like some of the words in spells are things you don't find in the real world.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But if nothing else, it's class specific. If you're not playing a spellcaster, if you're playing a fighter, you can get by based entirely on just fighting vocabulary.
Yeah, yeah, of course, yeah.
And that doesn't change that much from Dungeons and Dragons to the real world.
Okay, yeah, sure.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, a little bit more historical than with the long sword versus the short sword versus the broad sword and so on, but at the same time, you have to sit back and think the words that make that up are at least something you can visualize.
Right, yeah.
We're not using obscure terms like Zweihänder and...
Bastard sword
and Gladius.
Yeah, yeah, okay. I know what all of those are, by the way.
Yeah, that's the crazy thing. Yeah.
Actually, I think Zweihänder is German for two-hander.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
but it's used in English because it represents a sword so long it was supposed to be like anti-pole arm.
Okay.
Just swing it to crash through and break pole arms.
Oh. Yeah, I didn't know that. I just know it was like a two-handed, like really big, like a long two-handed sword.
But that is not specifically named in a lot of role-playing games.
No, not really. I mean, I've seen it used in some of them, but those are the games that have like way too many different kinds of swords. Like,
yeah, you know. That is a perfect example of where you'd have to compare, though. Like Warhammer 40K, there are three different levels for that. There's the base wargaming level, which absolutely it's this unit, this damage, this movement speed, da 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 da. On your turn, you control everybody in the army.
Okay, so it's more like an army kind of thing.
You could think of it more like a computer strategy game.
Hmm.
You do explain as you do and make your roles, but it's not really a role playing.
Right, right, right.
But at the same time, being Warhammer 40K, there's a lot of extra vocabulary that relates vaguely to English, but via old Latin, bastardized with...
like science fiction.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
The Adeptus Mechanicus declaring this device to be heretech. Heretical technology, right. Heretech.
I mean, I think that kind of speech wouldn't really help. And
It wouldn't. Yes and no. There would be a very big barrier because you would have to learn a lot of vocabulary specifically to just that system.
Right.
There would be a big barrier there. And yes, you could not use that vocabulary outside so much. However, being comfortable using that vocabulary would be, in its own way, a useful skill, adapting to words you don't initially recognize, and being able to comfortably repeat those back, use them based on how you hear them.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah, but the words themselves, no, you would not use in daily life.
No one would. I mean, no. Yeah.
No. So you can't at all say that is the reason why you're doing it that way. But at the same time, you could say, yeah, I want to do it that way because da 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 da.
Okay. Yeah.
And when you're doing it at the wargaming level, you remove dialogue. You remove explaining the action or how you do the action. It's just, I go here, I attack with my guns. My guns do this. I roll. Boom. This much damage.
All right. It's more basic.
It is much more basic. You were talking about before combat-focused games. This is the combat-focused game, the strategy combat-focused game. When you get that simple, that basic, everything is just, I do this. But that same system also includes only war, where instead of controlling the whole army, you are controlling a squad with individual units with their own character, their own backstory.
Right. Okay.
Still one person per squad, but at that level, you can at least recognize the personality behind the character, the specialization behind the character. And then you have an extra layer there with Dark Heresy where, yeah, it's got all that barrier to entry vocabulary you should learn. You could relate it back. Ground transport is a car. A manufactorum, factory. A chainsword, to be fair, a chainsword. There are no chainswords in this universe. But it's a chainsaw the size of a sword.
Yeah, that's more like a descriptive.
So, to sum up, here are some of the ways that you could work to adapt games to the classroom. when it comes to player engagement, do think a little bit about how much freedom players should have. And when it comes to adapting from video games, that can be hard. Definitely expect to change some vocabulary if you are using a pre-written module or video games for your source material. And yeah, you could use difficult vocabulary with your students from the game that they will not use in the real world, but definitely explain to those players, those students, why you can't use this in the real world, but what it does teach them. I think that's covered everything. Have fun! See you next time!
Thank you for listening to ESL RPG. This podcast is recorded at MT English School in Toyama, Japan.
Real quick, we'd like to say thank you to our patrons. So, thank you to our patron, King Michael, first of his name, master of Cherry Hafweisens, and ruler of the Land of Awesome.
Hi, this is David from ESL RPG. Thank you for listening. If you like what you hear, please consider supporting us by becoming a patron on Patreon at ESL RPG. Patrons get access to such benefits as updates on the future of the podcast, voting on one-shots, and access to full, unedited recordings. Also, if you are a game master or like role-playing, we recommend our friend Matt's Patreon at Milby's Maps. He creates massive maps for fantasy games, including castles and whole cities. If you like what you see, consider supporting him. Finally, one of the biggest ways you can support this podcast is by recommending it to any friends who might be interested. If you know someone who likes games, is studying English, or is looking for ideas for their classroom, let them know about us. Every new listener helps. Thanks for all the help, and see you next time!